best models, while on the other side there was the natural order of things. And he saw that in his struggle, in spite of extreme efforts on his part, and without any effort or even intention on the part of others, the only results achieved were that neither side was the winner, and that fine tools and splendid cattle and soil were quite uselessly damaged. But the chief point was that not only was the energy expended on the work wasted, but he could not help feeling now, when he saw the meaning of his pursuit laid bare before him, that the aim of his efforts was a most unworthy one. What was the essential cause of that hostility? He struggled to get every penny he could, and had to do so, or he would not have been able to pay his labourers their wages, and they struggled to be allowed to work quietly, pleasantly, and just as they were used to work. It was to his interest that every labourer should get through as much work as possible, and at the same time give his mind to it, not injuring the winnowing machine, the horse rake, or the threshing machine, but working intelligently. The labourer wished to work in the pleasantest way possible, with intervals of rest, and especially to think unconcernedly about other things, without having to reason. During that summer, Lievin noticed this continually. He gave orders to mow the clover for hay, choosing the inferior fields overgrown with grass and hemlock and not fit for seed, and they cut down all the best seed clover, defended themselves by saying that the foreman ordered them to do it, and comforted him with the assurance that he would get splendid hay, while he knew that they had done it simply because that clover was easiest to mow. He sent out the horse rake to turn the hay, and it got broken while tossing the first few rows, because the peasant found it dull to sit in the seat under the rotating wings, and Lievin was told, "Don't worry, sir, the women will toss it all in no time." The English ploughs turned out useless, because it never entered the peasant's head to lower the upturned ploughshare, and as he forced it through at the turning, he spoilt the ground and strained the horses. And Lievin was told not to worry. The horses were allowed to stray into the wheat field, because not one of the peasants wanted to be watchman. And in spite of its having been forbidden, the labourers took turns to watch the horses at night. So Vanka, who had been at work all day, fell asleep and confessed his guilt, saying, "I am in your hands, sir." Three of the best calves had been overfed by being turned into the meadow where the clover had been cut, without any water to drink, and the peasants would on no account admit that the clover had injured them. To comfort Lievin, he was told that his neighbour had lost 100 head of cattle in 3 days. All this happened not because anyone wished to harm Lievin or his farming. On the contrary, he well knew that they liked him and considered him a homely gentleman, high praise from a peasant. It was done simply because the labourers wished to work merrily and without care, while his interests were not only foreign and incomprehensible to them, but flatly opposed to their own just interests. Lievin had long felt dissatisfied with his relation to the work on his estate. He had seen that the boat was leaking, but had not found or looked for the leak, and perhaps had purposely deceived himself, for had he been disillusioned in that work, he would have had nothing left. But now he could deceive himself no longer. His agricultural pursuits had not only ceased to interest him, but had become repulsive, and he could no longer give his mind to them. Added to this, there was Kitty Shcherbatskaya, not more than 20 miles away, and he wanted to meet her, yet could not. When he called on Dolly, she had asked him to come again, and come with the object of once more proposing to her sister, letting him feel that her sister would now accept him. Lievin himself, having seen Kitty Shcherbatskaya, knew that he had not ceased to love her, yet he could not go to the Oblonsky's house while she was there. That he had proposed and she had refused him had put an impossible barrier between them. "I cannot ask her to be my wife just because she cannot be the wife of the man she wanted," he said to himself, and this thought rendered him cold and hostile toward her. "I shall not have the strength to speak to her without reproach, or to look at her without ill will, and she will only hate me all the more, as it is only right she should. Besides, how can I go there now, after what Darya Alexandrovna told me?
Can I help betraying what she told me? And I should come magnanimously to forgive her, to show mercy to her. I stand before her in the role of one who forgives her and honours her with his love. Why did Darya Alexandrovna tell me this? I might have met her accidentally, and then all would have come naturally. But now it is impossible.
Dolly sent to him to ask for a side saddle for Kitty. "I have been told," she wrote, "that you have a side saddle. I hope you will bring it yourself." That was more than he could stand. How can an intelligent woman with any delicacy so humiliate a sister?
He wrote 10 notes and tore them all up, sending the saddle at last without any reply. To say that he would come was impossible because he could not come. To say that something prevented him from coming or that he was leaving home was still worse. He sent the saddle without an answer, conscious of doing something shameful, and next day, putting the disagreeable management of the estate into the hands of the steward, he went away to a distant district to visit his friends Fiatsky, who had splendid shooting and had long been asking him to come and stay with him. The snipe marshes in the Surovsky district had for a long time appeared tempting to Levin, but he had put off his visit because of his farm work. But now he was glad to go away from the proximity of Kitty and from his farm, and especially to go shooting, an occupation which served him as the best solace in all his troubles.
Chapter 25. There was no railway or stagecoach to the Surovsky district, and Levin went in his own tarantas. Halfway, he stopped to feed his horses at a well-to-do peasant's house. The bald-headed, fresh-faced old man with a red beard which was growing grey round the cheeks opened the gates and pressed close to the post to let the three-horsed vehicle enter. After showing the coachman to a place in a lean-to, in a large, clean, tidy, newly constructed yard where stood some charred wooden ploughs, the old man invited Levin to enter the house. A cleanly dressed young woman with galoshes on her stockingless feet was washing the floor in the passage. The dog that followed Levin frightened her, but when she was told that it would not hurt her, she at once began to laugh at her own alarm. After pointing to the door with her bare arm, she again stooped, hiding her handsome face, and went on scrubbing.
"Want a samovar?" she asked.
"Yes, please."
The room Levin entered was a large one with a tiled stove and a partition. Under the shelf with the icons stood a table decorated with a painted pattern, a bench, and 2 chairs. By the door stood a little cupboard with crockery. The shutters were closed, and there were not many flies in the room, which was so clean that Levin took care to keep Laska, who had been bathing in the puddles on the way, from trampling on the floor, telling her to lie down in a corner by the door. Having looked round the room, he went out into the backyard. The good-looking woman in galoshes, with 2 empty pails swinging from a wooden yoke, ran down before him to fetch water from the well.
"Look alive!"
the old man called merrily after, and approached Levin.
"Is it to Nikolai Ivanich Sviasky you are going, sir?" "He too stops at our place," he began garrulously, leaning on the banisters of the porch.
In the midst of his conversation about his acquaintanceship with Sviasky, the gates creaked again, and the labourers returning from the fields came into the yard with their ploughs and harrows. The horses harnessed to the ploughs and harrows were big and well-fed. The labourers evidently belonged to the household. 2 young fellows wore print shirts and peaked caps. 2 others were hired men and wore homespun shirts. One of these was old and the other young. The old master of the house left the porch and went to unharness the horses.
"What have they been ploughing?" asked Levin.
"Between the potatoes. We too rent a little land. Don't let the gelding out, Fedot. Lead him to the trough. We'll harness another. I say, father, have those ploughshares I ordered been brought?"
asked a tall, robust young fellow, evidently the old man's son.
"There in the passage,"
answered the old man, winding the reins into a ring and throwing them on the ground.
"Fix them in before we finish dinner."
The good-looking woman returned, her shoulders pressed down by the weight of the full pails, and went into the house. Other women, young and handsome, middle-aged, old and plain, some with children, others without, appeared from somewhere. The chimney of the samovar began to hum. The labourers and the family, having attended to the horses, went in to dinner. Lievin took his provisions out of the tarantas and invited the old man to have tea with him.
"Why, I don't know. We've had tea once today," said he, evidently pleased to accept the invitation. "Well, just for company."
Over their tea, Lievin heard the whole history of the old man's farm. 10 years previously, he had rented about 400 acres from the landowner, and the year before he had bought them outright and rented another 900 from a neighbouring proprietor. A small part of the land, the worst, he let, and with the aid of his family and 2 hired men cultivated about 120 acres. The old man complained that his affairs were in a bad way, but Lievin knew that he only did so for propriety's sake, and that in reality his farm was flourishing. Had his affairs been in a bad way, he would not have bought land at 35 rubles an acre, would not have married 3 of his sons and a nephew, and would not have twice rebuilt his homestead after fires, nor rebuilt it better each time. In spite of the old peasant's grumbling, one could see that he was justly proud of his property, of his sons, his nephew, his daughters-in-law, his horses, his cows, and especially of the fact that his whole household and farm held together. From their conversation, Lievin gathered that he was not against new methods either. He had planted many potatoes which had already flowered and were forming fruit, as Lievin had noticed when passing the fields on the way, while Lievin's own potatoes were just beginning to flower. He ploughed the land for the potatoes with an English plough which he had borrowed from a landowner. He also sowed wheat. Lievin was struck especially by one little detail. The old peasant used the thinnings of the rye as fodder for the horses. Many a time when Lievin had seen this valuable food wasted, he had wanted to have it gathered up, but had found this impossible. On this peasant's fields, this was being done, and he could not find words enough to praise this fodder.
"What is there for the young women to do? They carry the heaps out onto the road, and a cart comes and fetches them." "There now, we landlords don't get on well because of the labourers," said Lievin, handing him a tumbler of tea. "Thank you," said the old man as he took the tea, but he refused sugar, pointing to a bit he still had left. "How can one rely on work with hired labourers?" he said. "It is ruination. Take Sviatsky now. We know what sort of soil his is, black as poppy seed, but he cannot boast of his harvests either. It's want of attention." "And yet you too use hired labour on your farm?"
"Ours is peasants' business. We look after everything ourselves. If a labourer is no good, let him go. We can manage for ourselves."
"Father, Finogan wants some tar fetched," said the woman with the galoshes coming in.
"That's how it is, sir," said the old man, rising.
And after crossing himself several times, he thanked Lievin and went out. When Lievin went into the back room to call his coachman, he found the whole peasant family at dinner. The women served, standing. The vigorous young son, with his mouth full of buckwheat porridge, was saying something funny, and everybody laughed heartily. The woman with the galoshes laughing more merrily than anyone as she refilled the bowl with cabbage soup. The handsome face of this woman with the galoshes might very well have had something to do with the impression of welfare that this peasant household produced on Lievin. That impression was anyhow so strong that he never lost it. And all the rest of the way to Sviatsky's he every now and then recalled that household, as if the impression it had left on him demanded special attention. Chapter 26. Sviatsky was marshal of the nobility in his district. He was 5 years older than Lievin and had long been married.
His young sister-in-law, whom Levin thought very pleasant, lived with them. He knew that both Sviazhsky and his wife wanted to see her married to him, Levin. He knew this as certainly as all so-called eligible young men know these things, though he could never have said so to anyone. And he also knew that although he wanted to marry, and although this girl, to all appearance very fascinating, ought to make a splendid wife, he could as soon fly as marry her, even had he not been in love with Kitty. And this knowledge spoilt the pleasure which he hoped his visit to Sviazhsky would give him. Levin had thought of this when he received Sviazhsky's invitation, but in spite of it he made up his mind that this idea of Sviazhsky's intentions was only an unfounded conjecture of his, and that he would go. Besides, at the bottom of his heart he wanted to put himself to the test, and again to estimate his feelings for the girl. Sviazhsky's home life was extremely pleasant, and Sviazhsky himself was the best type of social worker that Levin had ever known, and Levin always found him very interesting. Sviazhsky was one of those people, they invariably amazed Levin, whose judgment was very logical, though never original, and was kept quite apart from their conduct, while their manner of life was very definite and stable, its tendency being quite independent of their judgment, and even clashing with it. Sviazhsky was an extreme liberal. He despised the gentry and considered the majority of noblemen to be secretly in favour of serfdom, and only prevented by cowardice from expressing their views. He considered Russia to be a doomed country like Turkey, and the Russian government so bad that he did not think it worthwhile seriously to criticise its actions. Yet he had an official position, was a model marshal of the nobility, and when he travelled always wore a cockade and a red band to his cap. He imagined that to live as a human being was possible only in foreign countries where he went to stay at every opportunity. Yet he carried on very complicated and perfected agricultural pursuits in Russia, and carefully followed and knew what was being done there. He considered the Russian peasant to be one degree higher than the ape in development, yet at district elections no one shook hands with the peasants and listened to their opinions more willingly than he. He believed in neither God nor devil, yet he was much concerned by the question of improving the condition of the clergy and limiting parishes, and was at the same time particularly active in seeing that the church should be retained in his village. On the woman's question, he sided with the extreme advocates of woman's freedom, and especially the right to work. Yet he lived with his wife in such a way that it gave everybody pleasure to see the friendly relationship in which they passed their childless life, and had so arranged that his wife did nothing and could do nothing except share her husband's efforts to spend their time as pleasantly and merrily as possible. Had Levin not possessed the faculty of giving the best interpretation to people's characters, Sviazhsky's character would have presented no difficulty or problem to him. He would only have called him a fool or a good-for-nothing, and everything would have been clear. But he could not call him a fool, because Sviazhsky was not only very intelligent, but also a very well-educated man, who carried his education with extreme modesty. There was no subject with which he was not acquainted, but he only exhibited his knowledge when forced to do so. Still less could Levin call him a good-for-nothing, because Sviazhsky was certainly an honest, kind-hearted, and clever man, always joyfully and actively engaged on work highly prized by all around, and certainly a man who could never consciously do anything bad. Levin tried but could not understand him, and regarded him and his life as animated riddles. The Sviazhskys were friendly with Levin, and therefore he allowed himself to sound Sviazhsky and try to get to the very foundation of his philosophy of life. But it was all in vain. Each time that Levin tried to penetrate deeper than the reception rooms of the other's mind, which were always open to anybody, he noticed Sviazhsky seemed a little confused. A just perceptible look of fear appeared on his face, as if he were afraid that he would be understood by Levin, whom he met with good-natured, jocose resistance. Now, after his disillusion with the work on his estate, Levin was especially pleased to stay a while with Sviazhsky. Not to mention the fact that the sight of the happy doves in their well-ordered nest, so content with themselves and everybody else, had a cheering effect on him, he now wanted, dissatisfied with life as he was,
to get at the secret which gave Sviatsky such clearness, definiteness, and cheerfulness. Levin also knew that he would meet neighboring landowners at the Sviatskys, and it would be very interesting to talk and hear about farming, the harvest, the hire of labor, and all those questions which, though considered very low, seemed to him most important. These matters might not have been so important in the time of serfdom, and may be unimportant in England. In these cases, the conditions were, or are, settled. But with us, everything has only just been changed, and is only beginning to settle down. The question of how things will settle down is the only important question in the whole of Russia, thought Levin. The shooting did not prove as good as he had expected. The marsh had dried up, and there were hardly any snipe. He went about all day and only brought back three, but on the other hand he brought back, as he always did after a day's shooting, a splendid appetite, good spirits, and the stimulated mental condition which in his case always accompanied physical exertion. And when out shooting, while he did not seem to be thinking at all, he again and again thought about the old peasant and his family, and felt as if the impression made on him called not only for his attention, but for the solution of some problem related thereto. In the evening, at tea, a very interesting conversation sprang up, just as Levin had expected, in the company of two landlords who had come about some guardianship business. Levin sat beside the hostess at the tea-table, and was obliged to converse with her and her sister, who was sitting opposite him. The hostess was a short, fair, round-faced woman, beaming with smiles and dimples. Levin tried to find out through her the answer to the riddle so important to him presented by her husband, but he had not full freedom of thought because he felt painfully uncomfortable. This painful discomfort was due to the fact that her sister sat opposite to him in a dress that seemed to him to have been put on specially for his benefit, with a particularly low, square-cut décolletage showing her white bosom. Though her bosom was so white, or perhaps because it was so white, this square cut deprived Levin of his freedom of thought. He imagined, probably quite mistakenly, that the bodice was cut like that on his account. He felt that he had no right to look at it, and tried not to do so, but felt guilty because it was cut so. Levin felt as if he were deceiving someone, as if he ought to offer some explanation which was impossible, and therefore he kept blushing and was restless and uncomfortable. His discomfort communicated itself to the pretty sister, but the hostess did not seem to notice anything and purposely drew her sister into the conversation. "You say," the hostess continued, "that my husband cannot feel an interest in anything Russian? On the contrary, though he is happy abroad, he is never so happy there as here. He feels in his own sphere. He's so busy. And he has a gift for taking an interest in everything. Oh, you've not been to see our school?"
"I saw it. It is a little ivy-covered house?"
"Yes, that is Nastya's business," she said, pointing to her sister.
"You yourself teach?"
asked Levin, trying to look beyond the bodice, but conscious that if he looked in her direction he must see it.
"Yes, I have been and am still teaching, but we have a splendid master. And we have introduced gymnastics."
"No, thanks. No more tea," said Levin. And unable to continue the conversation, though he knew he was behaving rudely, he got up, blushing.
"I hear a very interesting conversation there," he added, and went to the other end of the table, where his host and the two landlords were sitting.
Sviatsky sat sideways, leaning his elbow on the table and turning his cup round with one hand, while with the other he gathered his beard together, lifted it to his nose as if smelling it, and let it go again. He looked with his glittering black eyes straight at an excited landowner with a grey moustache whose words evidently amused him.
The landowner was complaining about the peasants.
Levin saw clearly that Sviatsky could have answered the landowner's complaint so that the meaning of the latter's words would have been destroyed at once, but owing to his position he could not give that answer, and listened not without pleasure to the landowner's funny speech. This landowner with the grey moustache was evidently an inveterate believer in serfdom, and a passionate farmer who had lived long in the country. Levin saw signs of this in the way the man was dressed. He wore an old-fashioned shiny coat, which he was evidently not used to, and in his intelligent, dismal eyes, his well-turned Russian, his authoritative tone, evidently acquired by long practice, and in the firm movement of his fine, large, sunburned hands, the right one having an old wedding ring on the third finger. Chapter 27.
If it were not a pity to give up what has been set going, after spending so much toil, I would throw it all up, sell out, and, like Nikolai Ivanitch, go away, to hear La Belle Hélène, said the landowner, a pleasant smile lighting up his wise old face.
But we see you don't give it up, said Nikolai Ivanitch Sviatsky, so it seems it has its advantages.
Just one advantage. I live in my own house, which is neither bought nor hired, and there is always the hope that the people will come to their senses. You would hardly believe what drunkenness and debauchery there is. The families have all separated. They have not a horse nor a cow left. They are starving, yet if you hire one of them as a labourer, he'll spoil and break things and will even lodge complaints with the magistrate.
On the other hand, you too complain to the magistrate.
I complain? Never. Nothing could induce me to. It would cause such gossip that one would be sorry one tried it. At the works now, they took money in advance and went off. And what did the magistrate do? Why, acquitted them. Well, things are only kept going by the village tribunal and the village elder. He thrashes them in the old style. If it were not for that, one had better give up everything and flee to the ends of the earth.
The landowner evidently meant to tease Sviatsky, but the latter did not take offence. On the contrary, he evidently enjoyed it.
Well, you see, we carry on our work without such measures, I and Levin and he, Sviatsky said, smiling and pointing to the other landowner.
Yes, Mikhail Petrovich gets on, but ask him how.
Is his what you would call rational farming?
Said the landowner, ostentatiously using the word rational.
My farming is very simple, thank heaven, said Mikhail Petrovich. My farming is to have money ready for the autumn taxes. The peasants come along and say, be a father to us, help us. Well, of course, they're all our own people, our neighbours. One pities them and lends them what they want, enough to pay the one-third then due. But one says, remember, lads, I help you, and you must help me when necessary, at the oat-sowing or hay-making, at harvest time. And one agrees for so much work from each family. But it is true there are some dishonest ones among them.
Levin, who had long been acquainted with these patriarchal methods, exchanged a glance with Sviatsky, and, interrupting Mikhail Petrovich, addressed the landowner with the grey moustache.
How, then, in your opinion, should one carry on at present?
Why, carry on the way Mikhail Petrovich does, either pay the peasants in kind or rent it to them.
That is quite possible, but the wealth of the community as a whole is ruined by such methods. Where my land used to yield ninefold under serfdom with good management, it only now yields threefold when the labourers are paid in kind. Russia has been ruined by the emancipation of the peasants.
Sviatsky looked at Levin with smiling eyes and even made a just perceptible sarcastic sign to him, ridiculing the old man. But Levin did not consider the landowner's words ridiculous. He understood him better than he did Sviatsky. Much of what the landowner said subsequently to prove that Russia was ruined by the emancipation even appeared to him to be very true, new, and undeniable. The landowner was evidently expressing his own thoughts, which people rarely do, thoughts to which he had been led not by a desire to find some occupation for an idle mind, but by the conditions of his life, thoughts which he had hatched in his rural solitude and considered from every side.
The fact of the matter is, you see, that progress can only be achieved by authority, he said, evidently wishing to show that education was not foreign to him. Take, for instance, the reforms of Peter the Great, Catherine, and Alexander. Take European history. In the realm of agriculture, it is still more so. To name only potatoes, they even had to be introduced by force into this country.
Our primitive ploughs, you know, have not always been used. They must have been introduced at the time of the Rurik princes, and doubtless by force. Now, in our case, we landlords under serfdom applied improved methods of agriculture. We introduced the winnowing machines and all sorts of tools, organized the carting of manure, all by our authority, and the peasants at first resisted and afterwards copied us. Now that serfdom has been abolished and the power taken out of our hands, our agriculture, where it has been brought to a high level, must descend to a savage and primitive condition. That is how I look at the matter.
But why? If your farming is rational, you can carry it on with hired labour, said Sviatsky.
I have no power. By means of whose labour am I to carry it on?
Here we have it. The labour power is the chief element of agriculture, thought Levin.
Hired labourers, replied Sviatsky. Hired labourers don't want to work well with good tools. Our labourers understand one thing only, to get drunk like swine, and when drunk, to spoil everything you put into their hands. They'll water the horses at the wrong time, tear good harness, change a wheel with an iron tire for one without, or drop a bolt into the threshing machine in order to break it. They hate to see anything that is beyond them. That is why the level of agriculture has gone down. The land is neglected, overgrown with wormwood, or given to the peasants, and where 8 million bushels used to be produced, they now only produce 800,000. The wealth of the nation has decreased. If the same step had been taken with due consideration...
And he began to develop his plan of emancipation, which might have prevented this dislocation. But it did not interest Levin, and, as soon as the landlord had finished, Levin returned to the first proposition, and, trying to get Sviatsky to express his views seriously, said to him, "The fact that our agriculture is sinking, that it is impossible, our relation to the peasants being what it is to carry on our rational farming profitably, is quite true."
"I don't think so," said Sviatsky, now quite serious. "All I see is that we do not know how to farm, and that our farming in the days of serfdom was not at too high, but on the contrary, at too low a level. We have no machines, no good horses, no proper management, and we do not know how to keep accounts. Ask any farmer. He cannot tell you what is profitable for you and what is not."
"Italian bookkeeping," said the landowner scornfully.
"Keep your accounts as you will. If they spoil everything you have got, you won't have a profit."
"Why spoil everything? They will break your inferior Russian threshers, but they cannot break my steam threshing machine. The poor Russian hack, what do you call it, of the breed that you have to drag along by the tail can be spoiled, but if you keep Flemish drays or good Russo-Danish horses, they won't spoil them. And it's by such means that we must raise agriculture to a higher level."
"Yes, if one can afford it, Nikolai Ivanich. It is all very well for you. But I have a son at the university to keep, and to pay for the little one's education at the secondary school, so that I cannot buy Flemish drays."
"We have got banks for such cases."
"Yes, and finish by being sold up by auction? No, thank you."
"I do not believe that it is either advisable or possible to raise the level of agriculture," said Levin. "I go in for it, and have means, but I never could do anything. I do not know to whom banks are useful. I, at any rate, never spend money on improvements without loss. Expensive cattle bring me a loss, and machinery, too."
"Yes, that is quite true," said the landowner with the grey moustache,
and he even laughed with pleasure.
"And I'm not the only one," continued Levin. "I can refer you to many farmers who carry on rational farming, and with rare exceptions they all make a loss on it. You just tell us... Is your farming profitable?" said Levin, and at once noticed a momentary expression of fright which he had observed before on Sviatsky's face when he tried to penetrate beyond the reception rooms of his mind. Besides, this question was not quite honest. His hostess had told him at tea that they had engaged that summer a German from Moscow, an expert bookkeeper,
and paid him 500 rubles to audit their accounts, and he found that they lost 3,000 rubles odd a year on their farming. She did not remember the exact figure, though the German had calculated it down to a quarter of a kopeck. The landowner smiled when the profits of Sviatsky's farming were mentioned, evidently aware of the sort of profits that his neighbour, the Marshal of the Nobility, was able to make. "It may be unprofitable," answered Sviatsky, "but that only shows that I am either a bad farmer or that I spend capital to raise the rent."
"Oh, dear, the rent!" exclaimed Levin, quite horrified. "There may be such a thing as rent in Europe, where the land has been improved by the labour put into it, but with us the land gets poorer by the labour put into it, that is, by being ploughed up. Therefore there can be no such thing as rent."
"No rent? Rent is a natural law."
"Then we are outside that law."
"Rent does not explain anything in our case, but on the contrary only causes confusion. But you had better tell us how the theory of rent can be... Would you like some curds and whey? Mary, send us some curds and whey. Or some raspberries here," said Sviatsky to his wife. "This year the raspberries are lasting an extraordinarily long time." And Sviatsky got up cheerfully and moved away, evidently regarding the conversation as finished at the very point where, to Levin, it seemed to be just beginning. Having lost his interlocutor, Levin continued the conversation with the landowner, trying to prove to him that all our difficulties arise from the fact that we do not wish to understand the characteristics and habits of our labourers. But the landowner, like everybody who thinks individually and in solitude, was obtuse to other thoughts and tenacious of his own. He insisted that the Russian peasant was a pig and loved piggishness, and that, to lead him out of the pigsty, power was needed, but there was no such power. A stick was necessary, but we had exchanged the thousand-year-old stick for some kind of lawyers and prisons, in which the good-for-nothing stinking peasants were fed with good soup and provided with a given number of cubic feet of air. "Why do you think," asked Levin, trying to bring him back to the question, "that we could not establish some relation with labour which would make it remunerative?"
"It will never be done with Russians. We have no power," answered the landowner.
"What new conditions could be discovered?" said Sviatsky, who, having eaten his curds and whey and lit a cigarette, now returned to the disputants. "Every possible relation to the power of labour has been defined and investigated," he said. "The remnant of barbarism, the primitive commune with its reciprocal bonds, falls to pieces of itself when serfdom is abolished, and there is nothing left but free labour. Its forms are defined and ready, and we must accept them. The labourer, the hired man, the farmer. You cannot get away from them."
"But the rest of Europe is not satisfied with that system."
"No, it is dissatisfied, and it is seeking new methods. It will probably find them."
"All I wish to say is," said Levin,
"why should we not seek them for ourselves?"
"Because it would be just the same as inventing new methods of building a railway. They are invented and ready."
"But if they don't suit us, if they are stupid," said Levin.
And again he noticed a look of fear in the eyes of Sviatsky.
"Oh, yes, it is all child's play for us. We have discovered what Europe is looking for. I know all that. But excuse me, do you know what has been accomplished in Europe with regard to the labour question?"
"Not much."
"The question is at present occupying the best brains in Europe. There is the Schulz-Delitzsch trend. Then there is a whole gigantic literature on the labour question with the most liberal LaSalle tendency. The Mulhausen system? That is already a fact. I expect you know about it."
"I have some idea about it, but very vague."
"Oh, you only say so. I'm sure you know about it just as well as I do. I am, of course, not a professor of sociology, but it interests me. And really, if it interests you, you had better study the matter."
"But what have they arrived at?"
"Excuse me." The landowners had risen. And Sviatsky, having again checked Levin in his disagreeable habit of prying beyond the reception rooms of his mind, went to see his visitors off. Chapter 28. Levin felt intolerably bored by the ladies that evening. He was more than ever excited by the thought that the dissatisfaction with work on the land, which he now experienced, was not an exceptional state of mind, but the result of the condition of agriculture in Russia generally, and that some arrangement that would make the labourers work as they did for the peasant at the halfway house was not an idle dream, but a problem it was necessary to solve. And he felt that it could be solved, and that he must try to do it. Having said goodnight to the ladies and promised to stay a whole day longer in order to ride with them and see an interesting landslide in the state forest, Levin, before going to bed, went to his host's study to borrow the books on the labour question which Sviatsky had offered him. Sviatsky's study was an enormous room lined with book cupboards. There were two tables in it, one a massive writing table, the other a round one on which lay a number of newspapers and journals in different languages, arranged as if they were mats round the lamp in the centre. Beside the writing table was a stand with gold-labelled drawers containing various business papers. Sviatsky got down the books and settled himself in a rocking chair. "What is it you're looking at?" he asked Levin, who, having stopped at the round table, was looking at one of the journals. "Oh, there is a very interesting article there," he added, referring to the journal Levin held in his hand. "It turns out that the chief agent in the partition of Poland was not Frederick at all," he added with gleeful animation. "It turns out—" And with characteristic clearness he briefly recounted these new and very important and interesting discoveries. Though at present Levin was more interested in agriculture than in anything else, he asked himself while listening to his host, "What is there inside him? And why does the partition of Poland interest him?" And when Sviatsky had finished, he could not help asking him, "Well, and what of it?" But Sviatsky had no answer to give. It was interesting that it turns out, and he did not consider it necessary to explain why it interested him. "Yes, and I was greatly interested by that cross old landowner," said Levin with a sigh. "He is intelligent and said much that is true." "Oh, pooh! He is secretly a rooted partisan of serfdom, like all of them," said Sviatsky. "Whose marshal you are." "Yes, but I marshal them in the opposite direction," said Sviatsky, laughing. "What interests me very much is this," said Levin. "He is right when he says that our rational farming is not a success and that only money-lending methods like that quiet fellow's, or very elementary methods, pay. Whose fault is it?"
"Our own, of course. But it is not true that it does not pay. Vasil Chikov makes it pay. A factory."
"I still cannot understand what you are surprised at. The people are on so low a level, both of material and moral development, that they are certain to oppose what is good for them. In Europe, rational farming answers because the people are educated. Therefore, we must educate our people. That's all."
"But how is one to educate them?"
"To educate the people, three things are necessary. Schools.
"But you yourself just said that the people are on a low level of material development. How will schools help that?"
"Do you know, you remind me of the story of the advice given to a sick man. You should try an aperient."
"I have, and it made me worse."
"Try leeches."
"I have, and they made me worse." "Well, then, you'd better pray to God." "I have, and that made me worse."
"It's just the same with us. I mention political economy, you say it makes things worse. I mention socialism, you say still worse. Education? Worse and worse."
"But how will schools help?"
"By giving people other wants."
"Now that I never could understand," replied Levin hotly. "How will schools help the peasants to improve their material conditions? You say that schools and education will give them new wants?
So much the worse, for they won't be able to satisfy them.
And in what way knowing how to add and subtract and to say the catechism will help them to improve their material condition, I never could understand. The other evening, I met a woman with an infant in her arms and asked her where she was going. She replied that she had been to see the wise woman because her boy was fractious, and she took him to be cured. I asked her what cure the wise woman had for fractiousness.
She puts the baby on the perch among the fowls and says something.
Well, there is your answer. Education will stop them from carrying their children to the roosts to cure them of fractiousness, said Sviatsky with a merry smile.
Oh, not at all, said Levin, crossly. That treatment seems to me just a parallel to treating the peasants by means of schools. The people are poor and ignorant. This we know as surely as the woman knows that the child is fractious because it cries. But why schools should cure the ills of poverty and ignorance is just as incomprehensible as why hens on their perches should cure fractiousness. What needs to be cured is their poverty.
Well, in this at least you agree with Spencer, whom you dislike so much. He too says that education may result from increased well-being and comfort, from frequent ablutions, as he expresses it, but not from the ability to read and reckon.
Well, I'm very glad, or rather very sorry, that I coincide with Spencer, but it is a thing I have long known. Schools are no remedy, but the remedy would be an economic organization under which the people would be better off and have more leisure. Then schools would come.
Yet all over Europe, education is now compulsory. And how do you agree with Spencer yourself in this matter? A frightened look flashed up in Sviatsky's eyes, and he said with a smile, Yes, that cure for fractiousness is splendid. Did you really hear it yourself? Levin saw that he would not succeed in finding a connection between this man's life and his thoughts. It was evidently all the same to him what conclusions his reasoning led to. He only needed the process itself, and he did not like it when the process of reasoning led him up a blind alley. That he disliked and evaded by turning the conversation to something pleasantly jocular. All the impressions of that day, beginning with the impression of the peasant at the halfway house, which seemed to serve as a foundation for all the other impressions and ideas, agitated Levin greatly. There was this amiable Sviatsky who kept his opinions only for social use and evidently had some other bases of life which Levin could not discern, while with that crowd, whose name is Legion, he directed public opinion by means of thoughts foreign to himself, and that embittered landowner, with perfectly sound views he had wrung painfully from life, but wrong in his bitterness toward a whole class, and that the best class in Russia. And Levin's own discontent with his own activity, and his vague hope of finding a remedy for all these things. All this merged into a feeling of restlessness and expectation of a speedy solution. Left alone in the room assigned to him, and lying on a spring mattress which bounced unexpectedly whenever he moved a leg or an arm, it was long before Levin could sleep. Not one of the talks he had had with Sviatsky, though much that was clever had been said by the latter, interested him. But the landowner's arguments required consideration. Levin involuntarily remembered all that the man had said and corrected in imagination the answers he himself had given. I ought to have said to him, You say that our farming is not a success because the peasants hate all improvements and that these should be introduced by force. And if farming did not pay at all without these improvements, you would be right. But it succeeds where, and only where, as in the case of the man at the halfway house, the labourers act in conformity with their habits. Your and our common dissatisfaction with farming shows that we, and not the peasants, are at fault. We have long pushed on in our own way, the European way, without considering the nature of the labour force available. Let us consider the labourer not as an abstract labour force, but as a Russian peasant with his own instincts, and let us arrange our farming accordingly. Imagine, I ought to have said to him, that your farming is conducted like that old man's, that you have found means to interest the labourers in the results of their work, and have found improvements which they must recognise as such. Then, without impoverishing the soil, you will get double and treble the crops you get now. Divide equally and give half the produce to labour, and the share left for you will be larger, and the labour force will receive more. And to do this, we must lower the level of cultivation and give the peasants an interest in its success. How this can be done is a question of details, but it is certainly possible. This thought strongly excited Levin.
He lay awake half the night considering the details necessary for carrying his thought into effect. He had not meant to leave next day, but now decided to go away early in the morning. Moreover, there was the sister-in-law with the square-cut bodice who occasioned in him a feeling akin to shame and repentance caused by the commission of a bad action. Above all, he had to get away immediately to propose his new plan to the peasants before the winter corn was sown, so that the work might be done on the new conditions. He decided completely to reverse his former methods of farming. Chapter 29. The carrying out of Lievin's plans presented many difficulties, but he struggled with all his might to attain, if not all he desired, at any rate a possibility of believing without self-deception that the thing was worth doing. One of the chief difficulties was that the farming was actually going on, and it was impossible to stop it all and start afresh, so that the machine had to be altered while it was working. When, on the evening of his return, he informed the steward of his intentions, the steward, with evident pleasure, agreed with that part of the plan which showed that all that had been done up to then was foolish and unprofitable. He remarked that he had always said so, but had not been listened to. But to Lievin's proposal that he, like the peasants, should participate as a shareholder would in the farming, the steward only put on a look of great depression and expressed no definite opinion, but at once began to speak of the necessity of carting the last sheaves of rye next day and of starting the second ploughing, so that Lievin felt that it was not the time for his plans to be considered. When speaking of the matter to the peasants and offering them land on the new conditions, Lievin again met with the same difficulty. They too were so fully occupied with the labour of the day that they had no time to consider the advantages and disadvantages of the venture. The naive peasant, the cowman Ivan, quite understood Lievin's offer of letting him and his family have a share in the profits of the dairy farm, and quite sympathised with this undertaking. But when Lievin impressed upon him the benefit that would accrue to him in the future, a look of anxiety and regret that he could not stop to listen to it all appeared on Ivan's face, and he hurriedly remembered some task that could not be put off, seized a hay fork to remove the hay from the enclosure, fetched water, or cleared away the manure. Another stumbling block was the peasants' invincible mistrust of the possibility of a landlord having any other aim than that of robbing them as much as possible. They were firmly convinced that his real aim, whatever he might say, would always be hidden in what he did not tell them. And they themselves, when they talked, said much, but never said what they really wanted. Besides all this, Lievin felt that the splenetic landowner was right, the peasants put as the first and unalterable condition in any agreement that they should not be obliged to use any new methods or new kinds of tools for their work. They agreed that an English plough ploughed better, that a scarifier worked quicker, but they found a thousand reasons why they could not use either the one or the other. And though he was convinced that it would be necessary to lower his standards of farming, he disliked having to give up improvements the benefit of which was so clear. Yet in spite of all these difficulties, he got his way, and by autumn the scheme began to work, or at any rate it seemed so to him. At first, Lievin thought of letting the whole of his farm, as it stood, to the peasants, to the labourers, and to his steward, on the new co-partnership lines. But he very soon saw that this was impossible, and decided to divide up the different parts. The cattle yard, the fruit and vegetable gardens, the meadows and the cornfields, divided into several parts, should come under different sections. The naive Ivan, who, it seemed to Lievin, best understood the plan, formed an artel, consisting chiefly of his own family, and became partner in the dairy section. The far field that had lain fallow for 8 years was, with the aid of the intelligent carpenter Fyodor Yetsunov, taken up by 6 peasants' families on the new cooperative lines, and the peasant Shuraev rented the vegetable gardens on similar terms. The rest remained as before, but these 3 sections were the beginning of a new order and fully occupied Lievin. It is true that the dairy farm did not as yet go on any better than before, and Ivan strongly opposed heating the cowsheds and making butter from fresh cream,
maintaining that cows required less food when kept in the cold, and that butter made from sour cream went further, and that he expected his wages to be paid as before, not being at all interested to know that they were not wages, but an advance on account of profits. It was true that Fyodor Yatsunov's group did not plough the cornland twice with the English plough as they had agreed to do, pleading lack of time. It was true that the peasants of that group, though they had agreed to farm the land on the new conditions, did not speak of it as cooperatively held land, but as land held for payment in kind, and that the members of that group and Ryatsunov himself said to Levin, "If you would only accept money for the land, it would be less trouble for you, and we should feel freer." Moreover, these peasants, on all sorts of pretexts, kept putting off the building of the cattle sheds and granary they had agreed to put up on this land, and dragged the matter on till winter. It was true that Shurayev had taken steps to sublet the kitchen garden in small lots to the other peasants. He evidently quite misunderstood, and apparently intentionally misunderstood, the conditions on which the land was let to him. It was true that often when talking to the peasants and explaining to them the advantages of the plan, Levin felt that they were only listening to the sound of his voice, and were quite determined, whatever he might say, not to let themselves be taken in. He felt this especially when talking to the most intelligent of them, Ryatsunov, and noticing the play in his eyes, which clearly indicated his derision of Levin, and a firm resolve that if anyone was taken in, it should not be Ryatsunov. But in spite of this, Levin thought matters were getting on, and that by keeping strict accounts and insisting on having his way, he would eventually be able to prove to the peasants the advantage of these new arrangements, and that things would then go on of themselves. These affairs, added to the rest of the farming which remained on his hands, and the indoor work on his book, so filled Levin's whole summer that he hardly ever made time to go out shooting. At the end of August, he heard from a servant who brought back the side saddle that the Oblonskys had gone back to Moscow. He felt that by not having answered Dolly Oblonskaya's letter, a rudeness he could not remember without blushing, he had burnt his boats and could never visit there again. He had treated the Sviatskys just as badly, having left their house without saying goodbye. But neither would he ever visit them again. That made no difference to him now. The rearrangement of his farming interested him more than anything had ever done in his life. He read through the books lent him by Sviatsky, and having ordered various others that he required, he read books on political economy and socialistic books on the same subject. But, as he had expected, he found nothing in them related to his undertaking. In the works on political economy, in Mill, for instance, which he studied first and with great ardour, hoping every moment to find a solution of the questions that occupied him, he found various laws deduced as governing the state of agriculture in Europe, but he could not see why these laws, inapplicable to Russia, should be considered universal. It was the same with the socialistic books. They were either beautiful but inapplicable fancies which had carried him away when he was still at the university, or they were improvements and patchings up of the order existing in Europe, with which agricultural affairs in Russia have nothing in common. Political economy maintained that the laws by which the wealth of Europe had developed and is developing are universal and unquestionable laws. The socialistic teaching declared that development on those lines leads to ruin. But neither the one set of books nor the other so much as hinted at explaining what Levin and all the Russian peasants and landowners with their millions of hands and acres should do to make them as productive as possible for the general welfare. Having taken up this question, he conscientiously read everything relating to it, and he purposed going abroad in the autumn to study the question further there, so that what had often happened to him with other questions should not be repeated. Often, just as he was beginning to understand the idea in his interlocutor's mind and to explain his own, he would suddenly be asked, "And what about Kaufmann and Jones and Dubois and Michelli? Have you not read them? You should do so. They have elucidated the question." He now clearly saw that Kaufmann and Michelli had nothing to tell him. He knew what he wanted. He saw that Russia had splendid soil and splendid labourers, and that in some cases, such as that of the peasant at the halfway house, the labourers and land produced much, but that in the majority of cases, when capital was expended in the European way, they produced little, and that this happened simply because the labourers are only willing to work and work well in the way natural to them, and that their opposition was not accidental but permanent, being rooted in the spirit of the people. He thought that the Russian people, whose mission it is to occupy and cultivate enormous unoccupied tracts of land, deliberately, as long as any land remains unoccupied, kept to the methods necessary for that purpose, and that those methods are not at all as bad as is generally thought. This he wanted to prove theoretically in his book, and practically by his farming. Chapter 30. By the end of September, the timber for the buildings to be erected on the land let to the peasant group was carted, the butter was all sold, and the profits divided. Everything on the estate was going well, practically, at least Levin thought so. To elucidate matters theoretically and to finish his book, which, according to his dreams, would not only revolutionize political economy, but completely abolish that science and lay the foundation of a new science, that of the relation of the people to the land, it was only necessary to go abroad and there study what had been done on the subject and find convincing proofs that what had been done there was not what was needed. Levin was only waiting for the wheat to be delivered and to get paid for it before leaving for abroad. But rain set in, making it impossible to get in what remained of the corn and potatoes, stopped all the work, and even prevented the delivery of the wheat. The mud made the roads impassable. Two mills had been carried away by floods, and the weather was getting worse and worse. On the 30th of September, the sun showed itself in the morning, and, in hopes of fine weather, Levin began seriously preparing for his departure. He gave orders that the grain was to be got ready for carting, and sent the steward to the merchant to collect the money for the wheat, while he himself went round to give final instructions before leaving. Having got through all his business, soaked by the streams of water that had run in at the neck of his leather coat and at the top of his high boots, but in the most buoyant and animated spirits, he returned home in the evening. The weather grew still worse toward evening, and the frozen sleet beat the whole body of his drenched horse so painfully that it shook its head and ears and went sideways. But Levin, under his hood, felt comfortable. He looked cheerfully round, now at the turbid streams that ran down the ruts, now at the drops that hung from every bare twig, now at the white spots of unthawed sleet that lay on the planks of the bridge, or on the heaps of still juicy willow leaves lying in a thick layer round a denuded tree. Notwithstanding the gloomy aspect of nature around him, he felt peculiarly elated. His conversation with the peasants of the outlying village showed that they were beginning to get used to the new conditions. An old innkeeper, into whose house he had gone to dry himself, evidently approved of Levin's plan, and had offered to join a group to buy cattle. "I need only push on steadily toward my aim, and I shall achieve it," he thought. "And it is worth working and striving for. It is not a personal affair of my own, but one of public welfare. The whole system of farming, and above all the position of the people, must be completely altered. Instead of poverty, wealth and satisfaction for all. Instead of hostility, concord and a bond of common interest. In a word, a revolution, bloodless but immense. First in our own small district, then throughout the province, throughout Russia and the whole world, for a good thought must be fruitful. Yes, it is an aim worth working for. The fact that the author of it is myself, Konstantin Levin, who once went to a ball in a black tie, whom Kitty Shcherbatskaya refused, and who seems so pitiful and insignificant to himself, proves nothing. I feel sure that Franklin felt just as insignificant and distrusted himself just as I do when he remembered his past. All that does not matter. He, too, probably had an Agafya Mikhailovna to whom he confided his secrets. With such thoughts, Levin reached home when it was already dark. The steward, having been to the merchant, had returned, bringing an instalment of the money for the wheat.
An arrangement had been made with the innkeeper, and the steward, while away, had learnt that the corn had nowhere been got in, so that Levin's 160 stacks still in the fields were a trifle compared to what others were losing. Having dined, Levin, as usual, sat down in his easy chair with a book, and while reading, continued to think about his impending journey in connection with the book he was writing. Today, the importance of his work presented itself to him with especial clearness, and whole paragraphs of their own accord shaped themselves in his mind, expressing the gist of his thoughts. "I must write that down," thought he. "That must form a short preface, such as I formerly considered unnecessary." He rose to go to his writing table, and Laska, who was lying at his feet, stretched herself, also got up, and looked round at him as if asking where she was to go to. But he had no time to write his thoughts down, for the labourer's foreman had come, and Levin went into the hall to speak to them. After arranging about the next day's work by seeing the peasants who had come on business, Levin went to his study and sat down to his work. Laska lay down under the table, and Agafya Mikhailovna, with her knitting, sat down in her usual place. Having written for some time, Levin suddenly, with particular vividness, remembered Kitty, her refusal, and their last meeting. He rose and began to pace up and down the room.
"What is the use of fretting?" said Agafya Mikhailovna. "Why do you always sit at home? You should go to a watering place now that you've got ready."
"So I shall. I'm going the day after tomorrow, Agafya Mikhailovna, only I must finish my business."
"Eh? What is your business? Have you not done enough for the peasants as it is? Why, they're saying, 'Your master will get a reward from the Tsar for it.' And it is strange. Why should you bother about the peasants?"
"I am not bothering about them. I'm doing it for myself." Agafya Mikhailovna knew all the details of Levin's farming plans. He often laid bare his thoughts before her in all their details, and frequently argued with her and disagreed with her explanations. But this time she quite misunderstood what he said.
"Of course one must think of one's soul before everything else," she remarked with a sigh. "There was Parfion Denisich, who was no scholar at all, but may God grant everyone to die as he did," she said, referring to a servant who had died recently. "He received Holy Communion and extreme unction."
"I'm not speaking about that," he said. "I mean that I'm doing it for my own profit. My gains are bigger when the peasants work better."
"But whatever you do, an idler will always bungle. If he has a conscience, he will work. If not, you can do nothing with him."
"But you yourself say that Ivan looks after the cattle better now."
"I only say," answered Agafya Mikhailovna, evidently not speaking at random, but with strict sequence of thought, "you must marry. That is all."
Her mention of the very thing he was just thinking about grieved and hurt him. He frowned, and without replying, again sat down to his work, repeating to himself all that he had been thinking about its importance. Only occasionally, in the stillness, he listened to the clicking of her needles and, remembering what he did not wish to remember, made a wry face. At 9 o'clock he heard the sound of a bell and the heavy lurching of a carriage through the mud.
"There now. Visitors have come to you," said Agafya Mikhailovna, rising and going toward the door. "Now you won't feel dull."
But Levin overtook her. His work was not getting on now, and he was glad of a visitor, whoever it might be.
Chapter 31.